Right, I think we're recording. So, gravitational radiation. The purpose of this chapter is to really just complete the story of why we think GR is a very important theory. We looked at a number of specific predictions of general relativity for the Schwarzschild metric, and I hopefully demonstrated to you that all of those predictions have been shown observationally to be correct. The advance of perihelion of Mercury, the bending of light in a gravitational field, and the gravitational redshifting of light. The other major prediction of GR that has not yet been directly observationally verified is gravitational radiation. But one might as well say, well, have we ever seen an electron? I mean, we haven't really. Well, I mean, I hope that's true. I think it's probably still true to say that no one's held an electron in their hand and said, oh, there's an electron. But we believe they exist because of all the circumstantial evidence. The aspects of physical theories that make much more sense if we postulate the existence of electrons. And it's a bit like that, I think, with gravitational waves. That we've already seen in Chapter 3 that the advance of the pericenter of the orbit of the binary neutron star system and the shrinking of the orbit of the binary neutron star system is very consistent with what you'd expect if some of the energy of the system has been radiated away in the form of gravitational waves. We just haven't been able to detect that energy yet. And indeed, very recently, you might recall that I said that there was another new system called OJ287, which is a supermassive black hole with another black hole orbiting it, and it too is showing orbit precession and shrinking of the orbit. So in a range of scales from, you know, neutron stars that are 10 kilometers across to supermassive black holes that are in the core of galaxies, GR seems to work. It's a bit frustrating that we haven't directly detected gravitational waves yet, but as you well know, many people here in Glasgow are on the case, and we're hoping within the next 5 to 10 years that we'll make a successful direct detection. So what this chapter is all about is just to give you some theoretical foundations about gravitational waves to let you see, A, why do we think they're waves? Why do we think they exist at all? And why do we think they travel at the speed of light? Those are the three main outcomes of this chapter. So there's a great deal of what's in Chapter 5 that is non-examinable, but those three big ideas are certainly examinable. I would like you, at the end of this course, to be able to confidently say why you think gravitational waves are waves. They satisfy a wave equation, and that it propagates at the speed of light. So let's see how that all comes about. So the chapter kicks off with a mention of what we mean by a stationary metric. It's not quite the same as a static metric, because, for example, you could have a star which is rotating, and therefore there's a sense in which time is advancing. If you reverse the time coordinate, it would be a bit like making the star rotate the other way. But actually what we're interested in this chapter is a metric which is neither static nor stationary, one which is non-stationary. In other words, one where the metric coefficients actually depend on time, they vary in time. So, in considering space-times in which the metric components are time-dependent, as you might expect, that makes it pretty hard. So what we're going to restrict ourselves to is space-times where there are time-varying metric components, but we're going to make the space-time what is called nearly flat, and we'll see what that means in a moment. So page 2 is just really general chit-chat about the fact that at Glasgow we've been trying to find evidence of gravitational waves. Mentions the pulsars, just like I did a moment ago. So really we can pick up the story in page 77, where I mention weak gravitational fields. So we're going to derive the results in this chapter, most of which we're not going to derive at all, but the few results that we will derive are for weak gravitational fields. Excuse me. Okay, what do we mean by a nearly flat space-time? Well, if there's no gravitational field, then space-time isn't curved, it's flat. So if you've got a weak gravitational field, then it's maybe reasonable to say, well, what we mean by that is that space-time is nearly flat. So what exactly does that mean? It means that we can write space-time, the metric of space-time, in the form of equation 5.1. So we can find a coordinate system in which the metric takes the form of the Minkowski metric plus a small perturbation. So the Minkowski metric is the metric of special relativity. It's very simple. It's a diagonal metric and it's minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. And the small perturbation, which we denote by h alpha beta, is defined such that h alpha beta in modulus is very much less than 1 for all of its components. So remember, it's got 16 components potentially. So too does eta alpha beta, but 12 of them are 0, and the other 4 are minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. H alpha beta, all 16 components, are assumed to be small. So if you can find a coordinate system that satisfies equation 5.1, then we refer to that as a nearly Lorentz coordinate system. Equally valid name would be nearly Minkowski coordinate system, because it's nearly the same as the flat spacetime of Minkowski spacetime. Now, there might be another coordinate system in which the components look really complicated. We're not saying that any choice of coordinate system looks like equation 5.1. It's just that we can find at least one which does. And if you're, you know, perverse enough to want to choose a really complicated coordinate system, then that's fine. It doesn't violate the principle of covariance. The tensor equations of GR still apply in any coordinate system, but in some systems they look an awful lot simpler than others. So it's generally a good idea to try to find a coordinate system in which they look simple. And you can't get much simpler than 5.1, because it's just Minkowski spacetime plus a small perturbation. So that's what we're going to stick to. Now, as we know, the whole idea about relativity is about looking at the laws of physics in different coordinate systems. So okay, we've said that we can find a coordinate system in which it looks like 5.1, but what happens when you do change coordinate system? Well, the next main point to take out of this chapter is that there are two classes of coordinate transformation in which the metric taking the form of 5.1 is preserved. You know, you change to a new coordinate system, but it still looks just like 5.1. And those two classes of transformation, one is called background Lorentz transformations, and the other one is called gauge transformations. So I want to talk to you about what those are. So a background Lorentz transformation, again, there's lots of detail here, but if we sort of cut through the detail to the essential point, the detail consists of really recapping things that hopefully you remember, partially from earlier courses and certainly from Norman's course, that if you take a coordinate system undashed and then perform a Lorentz transformation, that's, in other words, you consider another inertial frame that's moving at some velocity v with respect to the first frame, then the coordinates in the new Lorentz frame, dash coordinates, are related to the undashed ones by equation 5.3. So this matrix here tells you how to transform from one Lorentz frame to another. So that's how it works in special relativity, but we're not talking about special relativity. We're talking about a spacetime that isn't flat, it's just nearly flat. So the question is, how does this translate to that case? So further down this page, there's just discussion of how one might represent that more compactly. You can represent it by a Lorentz matrix. This is the notation that Norman used. Or another way you can write that is in terms of the partial derivatives of the coordinates from dashed to undashed and vice versa. But what we want to know is, how does all of that affect the metric for a nearly flat spacetime? So, next page has got that. So what we want to do is to take our equation 5.1, which said g alpha beta is eta alpha beta, Minkowski spacetime, plus a small perturbation h alpha beta. What if we then transform to a new coordinate system? What will that look like? It'll look like equation 5.10. g dash alpha beta is eta dash alpha beta, but eta dash is actually, the components of that are just the same, because eta alpha beta is minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. And if you transform to another Lorentz frame, eta is still the same. It's still minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So that's unchanged. But the h term, well, that gets pre-multiplied by these transformation terms. So in other words, the h part, the perturbation to Minkowski spacetime, actually winds up looking as if it transforms like a tensor, like a 2-0, rather a 0-2 tensor. So the bit I'm just highlighting with the wee hand at the moment in equation 5-10, that will transform as if it's the components of a 0-2 tensor. The physical importance of that is the following. It says that if you identify a nearly flat spacetime, a nearly Lorentz spacetime, and then you say, well, how would this look to another observer who's moving in another inertial frame? Does that person still see it as nearly flat? Well, the answer is yes, because all we do basically is define the new term involving h mu nu and the transformation terms. We define that as h dash alpha beta, and provided those terms are quite small, then it still satisfies the condition we had for equation 5.1. Now those terms might not be quite small if you're travelling close to the speed of light, but if you're not travelling very fast, then the dx mu by dx dash alpha, dx nu by dx dash beta, those terms are going to be very close to 1. So if h mu nu was very much less than 1, then so too is h dash alpha beta in the new coordinate system. All of that basically means is that if you find a nearly flat spacetime in one coordinate system, it will still look nearly flat to another observer, provided they're not moving too fast. Okay? So nearly flatness seems to be a property that gets preserved when you change from one inertial frame to another. What about gauge transformations? Well, there's a lot of quite scary notation here, but most of it we can safely disregard. What's going on, to let you see the essence of it, is that you've got a coordinate system, and then you wiggle that coordinate system a bit. You introduce some small changes to the coordinates. So equation 5.11 is just expressing that algebraically. You've got your original coordinate system, x alpha, and you add on some little wiggles to that coordinate system to make a new coordinate system, x dash alpha. So why you might wish to do that might be that by introducing a slightly different coordinate system, maybe you can simplify the equations a bit. And we'll see later that that's exactly what happens. We call this a gauge transformation, and it mirrors the fact that in electromagnetism, sometimes one chooses a particular coordinate system or a choice of gauge to make the equations look simpler. It's the same kind of idea. So the wiggles, the psi alpha, I never quite know which Greek letter this one is. I think it's psi. I just draw it as a squiggle anyway, so it's kind of hard to tell. But when you do it in LaTeX, it does look a bit more professional. I think that one's psi. We're going to demand that those components, psi alpha, are all small. So that's defined by equation 5.14, that the psi alphas are small, and also that the derivatives are small. They're all very much less than 1. So in other words, you're not wiggling your coordinate system very much, just wiggling it a little bit. Then there's more stuff, lots more algebra. As I say, as the guidance notes I'll give you will make clear, all of this is safely material that you can disregard. You will not be asked to go through any of these derivations, but you might be asked just to explain in words what is meant by a gauge transformation. And, you know, as I've just said, you would describe it as just a small perturbation to your coordinate system. And as a result of applying that perturbation, we can ask the same question as before. We can see, well, what difference does it make to the metric? If you've got a nearly flat spacetime like equation 5.1, and you apply a gauge transformation, does it still look nearly flat? Well, the answer again is yes, because here's what you get. You get equation 5.18. You've still got the Minkowski metric, plus an extra bit, but the extra bit is now three pieces. It's the original h alpha beta from equation 5.1, plus two terms that are related to the wiggles that you've added onto your coordinate system. But those terms are going to be small because we've assumed that we're only considering small ones. So as you see in equation 520, we can just redefine the wiggles in our coordinate system as h dash alpha beta is the original perturbation plus the wiggles that we've added by introducing this gauge transformation. So our new prime coordinate system is still nearly Lorentz. So again, just to summarise in words, what's really going on is that you're saying that if you identify a coordinate system that's nearly flat, or space-time is nearly flat, it's a nearly Lorentz coordinate system, then you can wiggle it a little bit and it will still look nearly flat, provided the wiggles are small. Okay? Now, you know, there's a lot of math detail to back all of that up, but I don't really think that need concern us. It maybe would be more relevant to a course in differential geometry, but this fundamentally is a course concerned with the physics, and I think that's all we need to say. Okay? So, let's just read that again. It's another chance for it just to sink in. Given that we've identified a coordinate system which is nearly Lorentz, we can add an arbitrary small vector to the coordinates, perturb them a little bit, and our assumption that space-time is nearly flat is not altered as long as our perturbation isn't too much. Okay? Right, so that's the first major step towards the key results of this chapter. The next major step, I'm just going to highlight the results, but not how you get them. Although some of the results actually aren't too hard to derive, and there's a couple of examples on the example sheets that you might want to try. The first one in particular is, what does the Riemann-Christoffel tensor look like for a weak gravitational field? So the Riemann-Christoffel tensor is the tensor that describes the curvature of space-time. So if space-time is nearly flat, then that would tell us that we'd expect the Riemann-Christoffel tensor to be nearly zero, because space-time is nearly flat. Does that check out? Well, it does, although the algebra is a bit messy. Here's the expression for the Riemann-Christoffel tensor, and it involves the metric, and it involves the Christoffel symbols. So that's a result that I guess Norman first derived and has cropped up a few times in this course as well. So, if we substitute in that the metric is just the Minkowski metric of special relativity plus a small perturbation, in other words, equation 5.1, what do you get? Well, what you get is equation 522. Equation 522 is what the Riemann-Christoffel tensor reduces to if space-time is nearly flat, and what it reduces to is second-order partial derivatives of the perturbation to the Minkowski metric. So since the perturbation to the Minkowski metric was small to begin with, taking its derivatives, those are going to be small as well, then sure enough, like I said, the Riemann-Christoffel tensor is going to be small. It's going to be close to zero. That figures because we're assuming space-time is nearly flat. So, example sheet 2.2 invites you to derive that result just by directly substituting into 521 the expression for G, and then that implicitly is there in the expressions for the Christoffel symbols. The algebra is messy, but it's not terribly hard. You're just throwing away everything which is second order, or which is higher than second order. Right. The reason we want to do this is that the Riemann-Christoffel tensor encodes information about the curvature of space-time, which in turn, in the first half of this course, when Norman was working through this, led you to derive what we call the Einstein tensor, which was then equated to the energy-momentum tensor or stress-energy tensor. That was Einstein's equations. So what we want to do is to do that for a weak gravitational field. Now, I meant to check, but I actually think Norman might have done this anyway. But the next wee section just goes through all of that. It goes through the derivation of Einstein's tensor for a weak gravitational field. So we've already got an expression for the Riemann-Christoffel tensor. We then turn that into the Ricci tensor. There's a couple of notational things that I'll mention in just a minute, more explicitly, but they're all there for you to see. On the algebra goes, we work out an expression for the Einstein tensor for a weak gravitational field, and it's pretty horrible. There's like six terms. But the point is, they all involve small things. They all involve this metric perturbation H, which we assume to begin with was pretty small. So the Einstein tensor is a sum of small quantities. And you'll see when I circulate the detailed list of things you can disregard, but this is definitely one of them. You do not need to be able to derive the Einstein tensor for a weak gravitational field. It's just rather very tedious algebra and not all that much underlying physics. And the good news is anyway that almost all of the terms in equation 529 can be shown to be zero. Now they're not zero in any coordinate system, but what can be shown is that you can choose a coordinate system that sets them zero, and that actually involves choosing a gauge. So this is why I mentioned this thing about gauge transformations. It's demonstrating that if you've got a nearly flat space-time and you apply a gauge transformation, it's still nearly flat. So why would you want to? The reason you might want to is because it will greatly simplify Einstein's equations. And that's exactly how it works. Instead of having six terms in the Einstein tensor, by choosing a suitable gauge, you can reduce it first of all to four, and then you can reduce it to only one. And the steps involve defining a new form of the metric perturbation, which we put a bar above, and this is called the reverse trace form, because what you do is you subtract off h, which is h mu nu contracted with the metric. It's sort of, if you think of h mu nu as a matrix, a 4x4 matrix, then h is just the sum of the diagonal terms, what the mathematicians call the trace of the matrix. So that's what's going on. Introducing this h bar mu nu is just a way of simplifying the equations. So straight away we've knocked the six terms in 529 down to only four. And there are some tricks that can be brought in to get rid of three further ones of those. Remember, physically why we're doing all this is because we want to equate the Einstein tensor to the energy momentum tensor. That's Einstein's equation. That's really what GR is all about. So we've got our four terms, which is the simplified Einstein tensor doing this reverse trace transformation, and that has to equal 16 pi times t mu nu. But if you're in empty space, then t mu nu is going to be zero. And if you choose your gauge carefully enough, then three of the terms on the left-hand side can be set to zero as well. So what you wind up with is 536. Now, if I'd showed you that even at the beginning of the course, all the more so at the beginning of the year before Norman started, you'd just think, what on earth do all those symbols mean? In fact, you still might be saying that because there's a bit of strange notation going on there. 537 is really the crucial one. If we write it, I write it big, eta alpha alpha into h nu nu comma alpha alpha bar. So what we're doing is we're taking h mu nu bar, which was defined a couple of pages back, it's related to the original metric perturbation, and we're taking partial derivatives, we're taking second order partial derivatives, and alpha appears twice, so it's basically not cross terms, it's not like, you know, d2x dy, but it's d2 by dx squared, d2 by dy squared, d2 by dz squared, and also, crucially, d2 by dt squared. If you let alpha go from 0, 1, 2, 3, then it's going t, x, y, z. But then we've got eta alpha alpha, so we're summing over the alphas. So if we write that in a less intimidating form, it looks like equation 538. So those two are the same thing. Because remember, eta is just a diagonal matrix, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. So if you sum the diagonal terms, essentially contracting eta with h mu nu partially differentiated, you get 538. We should also remember that throughout most of this course, we've been setting the speed of light equal to 1. Let's not, just for a minute, let's put the speed of light explicitly back in, because if we do that, then it lets us notice that eta 0, 0, which is what you get, you know, the first term when you contract over alpha, it's a sum, Einstein summation convention, 0, 0, 0, 0 there, 1, 1, 1, 1 there, 2, 2, 2, 2 there, 3, 3, 3, 3 there. Well, the eta upper index 0, 0 is minus 1 over c squared. And that means that we can rewrite 538, finally, in the form of 540. Now, you might think, or maybe you wouldn't think this because I haven't said it yet, but I hope some of you at least would recognise that as a wave equation before I even say so. But it is. It's a wave equation. It's got the same form as the wave equation of water waves, of electromagnetic waves. And you might think, well, where did that come from? It's just come sort of, you might say, almost out of thin air. All this maths and talking about the Einstein equations, and suddenly we've got ourselves a wave equation. But that really is the key result for this chapter. Because starting off just by assuming that we have a nearly flat space-time, what we've shown is that the perturbations that we've added to Minkowski space-time, and we've said they have to be small because otherwise it wouldn't be nearly flat, those perturbations obey a wave equation. And the wave equation propagates at the speed of light. Now the fact that it propagates at the speed of light really comes directly from the fact that this is the Minkowski metric of special relativity. So it's already hardwired in there as soon as you accept the postulate of special relativity that every observer, every inertial observer, measures the speed of light to be the same. So people sometimes say to me, and it's a very good question, how do we know that gravitational waves propagate at the speed of light? Well, we don't really. But if you build up general relativity as an extension of special relativity, which obeys the equivalence principle, which means locally, curved space-time reduces to flat space-time, then you're really forcing the perturbations of the metric to propagate at the speed of light. So if somebody measured that gravitational waves weren't propagating at the speed of light, I mean, I for one will be content if we just measure them at all. I haven't done that yet. But an equally interesting question will be, what's their propagation speed? If it turns out to be different from c, then that would be bad news for GR. It would suggest that GR is wrong, because GR hardwires in the prediction that that speed there is the speed of light, that gravitational waves propagate at the same speed as electromagnetic waves. And it's all to do with the central role played by special relativity in deriving GR. So, to be practical about this and to let you see what I might reasonably expect you to be able to do, in addition to be able to just kind of state in words what is meant by nearly flat space-time, I think it's also reasonable that if I give you like this equation here, or maybe even further back where you've got Einstein's equations for a nearly flat space-time, I absolutely stress I would not expect you to be able to derive those because it's just pages of algebra. But if I give you Einstein's equations, then, well, the kind of things that I think it's reasonable for you to be able to say is, if it's empty space, then t mu nu is going to be zero. So the right-hand side of the equation is going to be zero. And to be able to turn this term, by recognising what that actually means, into this term, 540. I think that's a reasonable set of steps that, you know, I'd expect you to be able to do the algebra, but much more importantly than just writing the maths down, to be able to recognise that equation 540 is a wave equation, and it's the wave equation of a wave propagating at the speed of light. Because really that is the crucial thing here. The waves in this case are the perturbations in our metric. That's why people talk about gravitational waves as ripples in space-time. The space-time curvature is described by the metric, but it's not fixed. It changes. You know, the usual analogy we use for this is thinking of a trampoline. Somebody jumps on the trampoline, you jump up and down, but the trampoline wobbles as well. That's what space-time is doing, in some loose sense, when gravitational waves propagate through it. It's the ripples in the curvature of space-time itself, and they propagate at the speed of light. Okay? Now, there's not really much else that is crucial to get out of this chapter, because much of the detail I mentioned earlier in the course is now covered in a graduate level course that we do for SUPA, the Scottish Universities Physics Alliance. I also cover lectures on this sort of stuff at European level for the European Gravitational Wave Collaboration. That's quite nice because the lecture course is usually in Pisa, so I get to go there for a week. And I always say to our students that, well, you know, you can get a very brief version of it in the GR course, you can get a slightly longer version of it in the SUPA course. If you want the full-blown version, then come to Pisa. I'm afraid you don't have that option, but maybe some of you might continue with this after your degree. There's a lot more to the field of gravitational waves, both theoretically and experimentally, but we're just going to pick out a couple of highlights and that's all. Okay, and again, I'll make it very clear in the guidelines as to how much of the rest of this chapter you can safely disregard, and the answer is quite a lot. The key features of gravitational waves we've really already stated. The ripples in space-time, and they propagate at the speed of light. But we'd like to know just a bit more about them. So let's see what we can tease out in the final 15 minutes. Let's start off by assuming that they're plane waves. That means that we look for solutions of the form of 541. This is pretty much what we do for electromagnetic waves as well, but there's a key difference. In the electromagnetic case, then you're describing a vector, like the electric field vector or the magnetic field vector. In this case, it's a tensor. So what we've got to do is allow the amplitude of the wave not to be a single number, not even a vector, but actually to be a 4x4 matrix, a tensor, A mu nu. So we're saying that the metric perturbation, H bar mu nu, well, it's not exactly the same as the original metric perturbation, it's a kind of rescaled version because it made the equation simpler. H bar mu nu is the real part of some set of amplitudes, just collectively known as the wave amplitude, but it's not a scalar, and it's not even a vector, it's a tensor, multiplied by an exponential, and the wave vector is k alpha, so that's contracted with the coordinates x alpha. Actually, as written, k alpha are the components of a one form, but in the weak field limit, the difference between a contravariant and a covariant vector is not really all that important because space-time is close to flat anyway, and in Cartesian coordinates, the coordinates are exactly the same. Even if you're not in a Cartesian coordinate system, converting between one forms and contravariant vectors is very simple. Okay, so the next few pages just establishes a few ways in which we can simplify the form of the metric perturbation. The choice of the wave amplitudes and vector components is not arbitrary. First of all, we assume that the metric perturbation was symmetrical. Therefore, that means that the amplitude components are also going to be symmetric. And that's quite good because it reduces the number of independent components. It's a 4x4 matrix, but only 10 of those components are independent because the other ones are just a mirror image to preserve the symmetry. There's various little exercises. Now, in some previous years, I have made this examinable, but that's before we introduced the SUPA course on gravitational waves. So there is an example sheet question on this on sheet 3, but I'm not going to require you to be able to do this. You might still want to try the example, just because it's a good way to test how confident you are at manipulating tensors and vectors. But this is not something I'd expect you to be able to do in the exam. But nonetheless, one can show that k alpha, k upper alpha, when you take that inner product, you get zero. And that's a fancy way of saying that the wave vector is a null vector. When you take its inner product with itself, you get zero. Now, in Euclidean space, that would mean that the vector had length zero. But it's not as simple as that in Minkowski space-time, because you've got the minus dt squared plus dx squared dy squared dz squared. So it's not that big a deal for it to be a null vector. But in a way, this just confirms the idea of the wave propagating at the speed of light, because the four vector of a photon is also a null vector because it's travelling at the speed of light. Likewise, the four vector of our gravitational wave, or if you like, a graviton, because in a sense it's quite legitimate to talk about that, the equivalent charge carrier for gravity, it's travelling at the speed of light, so it's got a null vector. So that's not a surprising result physically, although to derive it mathematically is a wee bit tricky, hence the example. Then there's some more stuff that just goes through ways of establishing 547. Now what 547 is quite important. That says that the amplitude components of the gravitational wave as it propagates are orthogonal to the wave vector. So the gravitational wave is propagating in a particular direction. The amplitude of the wave is orthogonal to that. So just like an electromagnetic wave, the sort of the behaviour is actually transverse to the direction of motion. Okay? So that's what 547 expresses algebraically, just the idea that the wave amplitude, the disturbance in space-time, is orthogonal to the direction in which the wave is moving. Alright? But because we're dealing with tensors here, we've actually got multiple equations, and actually we can turn that from a problem into an opportunity because it allows us to simplify things yet further. Cue several pages of, again, rather complex algebra. So let's just cut to the chase, which is that we can define something called the transverse traceless gauge. The transverse bit we've already talked about, that says that the metric perturbations are transverse or orthogonal to the direction of motion of the wave. The traceless part, well, remember we introduced this quantity h bar alpha beta, which was equal to h alpha beta minus a term that involved h, which was the trace of the metric perturbation. Think about it in matrix terms, you just add up the elements along the diagonal. There were some other terms in there as well. Well, it turns out that a good choice of coordinate system is the traceless gauge in which h is zero. So actually, we didn't really have to bother adding that term anyway. But it's one of those situations where we added it in to make the equations initially simpler so that in the end we could then just reduce it to the case where the extra terms weren't there anyway. But it allowed us to show that the extra terms can always be made to vanish, even in more general cases. So basically, the h with the bar on top that we've been using in the last few pages is just the same as the original metric perturbation h alpha beta, provided we make this appropriate choice of coordinate system. It's called the transverse traceless gauge, and if we cut to the bottom line, the components of the metric and the transverse traceless gauge look like equation 562. So that's the amplitude of the metric perturbation. It can be simplified so that there are only are two non-zero components, EXX and EXY. The symmetry of the perturbation says you've got to have an EXY there as well, and the traceless nature of the perturbation says that when you add up the diagonal terms, they've got to give you zero. So you've got to have EXX and minus EXX. So there's only actually two independent components. We started off with 16, we reduced it to 10 by imposing symmetry, and we get rid of the other 8 by a suitable choice of coordinate system. So the original metric perturbation in its rescaled form with the bars above in the transverse traceless gauge, that's what the TT means. We noted that because it's traceless, it's actually just the same as the original metric perturbation expressed in this coordinate system. There's just two non-zero terms, HXX and HXY. So I would definitely not expect you to be able to produce all that algebra, but if you got a question that said this, what's the transverse traceless gauge and why is it useful, or words like that, then what they expect you to be able to say is that it's a particular choice of coordinate system which is very useful because it greatly simplifies Einstein's equations, and in particular identifies a solution for the metric perturbation which has only got two independent components. That's really what equation 564 is saying. Okay, so we're nearly done on gravitational waves. There's only really a couple more points to bring out. So I'll skip a wee bit of the material that's just at the top of 92. It's not really very important, but things get important just at the bottom of 92. It's really the last big point to make. We just want to end this very brief discussion of gravitational waves by thinking about what will be the effect of the passage of a gravitational wave. What will it actually do? So what the bottom of 92 does is works out what effect the gravitational wave will have on the proper distance between two particles. So the particles are just sitting there. They could be mirrors, which is effectively how the gravitational wave detectors work. You put a mirror well separated at either end of a laser beam tube, and you try to see if there's any change in the distance between the mirrors. If there is, then it will change the light travel time for the laser, because the speed of light's still the same. Therefore, you'll see it as interference fringes. That's how the detectors work. So what are we expecting they might see? So equation 571 gives you an expression for delta L. That's the proper distance between two points in space-time. And it's the integral along the path between the points of the metric, well, it's just ds squared, the square root of ds squared, the interval. So ds squared we can write as g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. So we're going to simplify that as follows. We're going to say, let's put our coordinate system origin where one of the test particles is, and let's put the other test particle at x equals epsilon, y equals z equals zero. And it's all happening at t equals zero at the same time. So the proper distance between the two particles is just the integral from zero to epsilon of the square root of gxx, because dy is zero, dz is zero, and dt is zero. Okay? And if epsilon's small, we can approximate that as the square root of gxx evaluated at x equals 0 multiplied by epsilon. All we've done is we've said, no, we take the integrand outside the integral and assume that it's constant. If epsilon's small enough, then that's okay. Now, gxx can be written, this takes us all the way back to the very first equation, 5.1, as the metric of Minkowski spacetime plus a small perturbation. We now know that that small perturbation looks quite simple if we choose the transverse traceless gauge, so we'll call it HXX with a TT. But we're supposed to take the square root, let's just go back to the previous page to show you again, we're supposed to take the square root of GXX. Now, ETAXX is 1, because the metric of Minkowski spacetime is minus 1, that's the eta TT term, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. So what we've actually got here is 1 plus a small quantity. And we're taking the square root of all of that. So the square root of 1 plus a small quantity can be approximately written as 1 plus half the small thing. And all of that was to be multiplied by epsilon. So here's the final of key point to take from this chapter. We've established that gravitational waves are waves and that they propagate at the speed of light. What effect do they have on test particles? Well, they do have an effect, because what this equation 574 says is that the proper distance between them doesn't remain constant, because hxx doesn't remain constant. Remember, that's a wiggle. We approximated it in a few minutes ago as like the real part of some kind of sinusoidal variation, or you know, e to the i theta. So if hxx isn't constant, then it's going to follow that the proper distance between the particles will also change. And that is what the gravitational wave detectors are trying to detect. Okay, they're trying to detect changes in the proper distance between them. Now, there's a whole bunch of complicated algebra that is then waded into to derive the geodesic equation for the separation of the particles. But we're not going to worry about that in this course, because it's really all more appropriate to the super course on gravitational wave detection. So let me just end with a picture, because I think being able to draw the picture is reasonable to be able to ask you to be able to do that. But the mathematical derivation of the results that led up to it, I think, is not necessary. Actually, just before, I know I'm a bit over time, but I'll really will be done in just a moment. I just wanted to remind you again that there are two free parameters here. You've got hxx and hxy. Both of those could be non-zero. Or if you like, what I'm really saying is that you've got two amplitudes that can be non-zero, axx and axy. They're the only two things. So there are two cases you could consider. You could consider the case where AXX is non-zero, but the other one's zero, and then you can consider the other way around. Okay? Now, this is all for a gravitational wave that's propagating in the Z direction. So remember, the displacement is transverse to that. That's why we call it the transverse traceless gauge. So what we expect the movements to be is in the XY plane. So if AXX is non-zero and AXY is zero, then the movements look like this. So if you start off with a ring of particles, then what will happen is they'll be sequentially squeezed in one direction and stretched in the other, and then it will reverse. And if, on the other hand, AXX is zero, but AXY is the one that's non-zero, then it's the same thing, but it's rotated through 45 degrees. So what this represents is two different polarization states for gravitational waves. Just like light can have different polarizations, but there the polarization states are separated by 90 degrees. For gravitational waves, they're only separated by 45. And on the course webpage, which if my computer is kind to me, it might let me get to. If I'm still connected to the web, I think I am. So let's just find that, and then I'll stop, because I'll let you see that there's a couple of wee Java applets that I wrote which show these polarization states. And provided you can just describe those qualitatively, then you needn't worry about all the quantitative derivation. So there you can see, they're not designed to hypnotize the class, but they do have a straight, weird hypnotic quality. The one on the left is where AXX is non-zero, and as you can see, it's squashing and squeezing, or stretching and squeezing, parallel to the X and Y axes. Whereas the other one is where AXY is non-zero, and the whole thing is rotated through 45 degrees. And we call these the two polarization states of gravitational waves. Okay, so the things you need to know about gravitational waves are...